You're listening to Neurodiversity at Work.
Life can be so shady. The way some people try to bring you down. Why's it got to be so crazy? Always trying to give you the run around.
Anne, welcome to the podcast. So pleased to have you on. And I guess just something to mention, first of all, before we get going today, because of the crazy kind of period that we're in, the podcast, it doesn't feel the same as what it was once before. I didn't used to have screaming kids in the background and there wasn't all kinds of chaos going on. But I guess that's what we can expect today, probably from both of us. So if you do hear kids screaming, they're not being punished for anything. They're merely just enjoying themselves. So Anne, would you like to let us know who you are, what you do?
Hi Theo. Yes, my name's Anne Cockayne. I'm a researcher in autism employment. I run my own company, working supporting employers and working with individuals on the autistic spectrum. And I'm here to have a chat about what I've been up to with my research and what I've found out from that.
Fantastic. Yeah. And we spoke, I can't remember, it seems like a lifetime ago now, Anne, but I was really fascinated by the work, the research that you've done. And I think it's kind of almost never more important now that we consider, what you're going to tell us, what you're going to let us into. So tell us a little bit about that then, I guess, you know, what neurodiversity means to you, why it's important and the journey you've been going on.
Okay. So I'm particularly interested in people with an autistic spectrum condition. I know neurodiversity, I'm sure your listeners will know some of this, that it's a massive umbrella term, lots of different conditions fall under that. But I'm particularly interested in what it's like to manage someone on the autistic spectrum, because although we know quite a lot about autism as a condition, we hear lots of stories from autistic people about the various challenges and strengths that they have. The under-researched area is that around what it's like in organisations and how a manager can make a massive difference to somebody's employment experience, for either good or for ill, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really difficult for managers as well, because, you know, it's a lot of managers want to do the right thing. They want to be able to help their employees, but often either they're misguided or they misunderstand the situation. And that, I've seen that causes real problems. So tell us about the research then. Tell us about what you understand, I guess, what the opportunities are from what you've seen.
Okay, so just to give a bit of context to the research, I interviewed about 30 managers and HR people that were interested in what I was doing, so they were willing to grant me access to their organisations, which is good because I got a good sample in there. I got big organisations, I got small organisations and people in the middle. And I think what struck me most is that the results I got weren't really organisation size specific. It was much more about the quality of the relationship between the manager and the person they were managing, whether that was in a big multinational, thousands and thousands of employees, or whether it was in a small office where somebody was working, with a team of five or six people. It's all about the person rather than the policies.
Definitely. And I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges for organisations, isn't it? Because it's around the individuals, how do you ensure that all your managers are given, I guess, the right support, the right training, the right development, so that they can help their employees? And I guess, do we need diagnosis? Do we need to understand the individuals and that they're neurologically different or not? I mean, what are your thoughts on the best way to support managers in this way?
Yeah, okay. So the way the law is set up at the moment is that you can't access support through reasonable adjustments or any other changes, and I can talk about some of those a bit later, unless you've got a clinical diagnosis. And of course, the issue that presents is there are many autistic people out there that do not see themselves as disabled, whereas the law says autism is a disability. So why would somebody who's doing well in work want to say that? It's a sensitive subject. Who wants to think of themselves as being disabled? So the law kind of lets us down a little bit in that respect, making it harder for managers. If they do see that that person's having some difficulty with the working environment, they can't really do anything until the person discloses themselves. And certainly in my research, I found that it was very rarely likely to be HR, seen as too distant, too remote from the individual. So if anybody was going to hear someone talk about being diagnosed or and go down the disclosure path, then it's going to be the first line manager, because that's the person they're closest to. And quite often that's the person they can trust much more than a remote HR department. So once they've done that, once they've disclosed, then the manager's in a great position to do something about that. It's usually around reasonable adjustments, but it's also about dealing with the knock-on. And by that, what I mean is what happens, what do you say to the wider team? Because this kind of disability tag, not everybody gets that autism isn't a disability. It's a disability in the eyes of the law, but it's not necessarily a disability to that person. And so a manager's got a real tightrope to walk between wanting to explain to people why someone might find bright lights difficult, or why they might need to take a few more breaks more often, or and the whole range of things that other people might think are a bit strange if they don't understand the reason why. But it's a confidential matter, so you know, the manager's bang in the middle of all of that, trying to negotiate something that preserves the individual's rights and confidentiality, but at the same time helps other people understand what's going on. Because it's that lack of understanding and lack of not knowing what autism is and how that shows itself in people in a working environment that causes some confusion.
Yeah, definitely. I was only mentioning the other day that it's a challenge, because I would never label myself as disabled, and I would never, at the point at which organisations, and we've been the same, ask, do you need a reasonable adjustment? Now, there may well be somebody who is, for example, in a wheelchair that has to have access, right? And they have to know that they can get access to the building when they get there. So they may need to check that, for example. There may be some adjustments needed for interview or whatever it may be. But for me, that's not the case. I don't understand that part for me, because I'm not disabled in my mind. But the reality is, if somebody asked me, do I need a reasonable adjustment at a different point, and it wasn't labelled disability, and maybe not even labelled reasonable adjustment, or, you know, is there anything we can do to help you have a better experience at interview? Then I may go, well, actually, yeah, you've got a test. Can you give me a bit more time? Can you give me the questions up front? You know, and maybe then I'm not even explaining that I'm dyslexic and ADHD, but it's allowing me to say, to ask that question. They could come back and go, well, a bit unfair, maybe to some other candidates. And then I can say, well, actually, you know, these are the reasons why. And I'm happy for you to also give that to the other candidates. You know, it doesn't just have to be me. So I absolutely agree. This is kind of a fundamental flaw in the system, but I think one that potentially we can work around. So it's interesting you mentioned that, I guess, from a legal standpoint, you need to be able to disclose. But actually, organisations can take it upon themselves just to decide. They can help individuals, irrelevant of whether or not they're saying they need a reasonable adjustment based on, you know, disability. What are your thoughts around that? I mean, because organisations should just be taking it upon themselves, should they not?
Yeah, I think so. I think that if you are a manager who has knowledge about autism as a condition and understands something about the things that autistic people would find difficult, like, for example, the bright lights, that's a really common one, but there are other things as well. If you're aware, if you're trained, if you're educated, if you're open as a manager through your organisation, diversity programs and obviously they're, you know, they move from different types of diversity, and it's difficult to cover every single part of knowledge about all the different diverse characteristics that are out there. But if an organization took it upon themselves to make sure that frontline managers particularly are up to speed with the kind of things to look out for, then of course, yeah, they can go straight in there and make sure they don't even have to have a conversation with the team or the autistic person. They can just sort out the lives and they can just make sure that the office is laid out in a sensible way. I mean, you mentioned right in the beginning this business about working environment and how that's changed. That's a massive opportunity for an autistic person. I've had people say to me, suddenly I can get my voice heard in team meetings. So when you're talking to people through Microsoft Teams or Zoom or whatever it is, that sort of small talk thing that sometimes people find awkward to do in work because they just want to get on with the detail of the task, which is a real characteristic I've found in the research that and a strength in autistic people. Suddenly the technology and the fact that people don't want to spend any longer than they have to staring at screens means that team meetings are becoming, I've noticed it myself, that team meetings, coaching conversations, whatever it is you're doing, a bit more focused. There's less time on the small talk and more time on the task in hand. So that's a massive opportunity for an autistic person because suddenly they can have their own lighting in their own office at home. They can manage the time, they can manage the interaction in a way that suits them best and brings out the best in on both sides.
Yeah, it's a really good point. The thing that's been going through my mind recently is this is a huge opportunity, but also it's not a real world situation, which I'm kind of grappling with. So, you know, for example, I enjoy working at home. I really enjoy working with people as well. So I like the balance of the two. Mm. However, I've got two children at home, or I may be hugely isolated or whatever it may be. So you've got all these other impacting factors that are not allowing you to experience this as it should be. So I do wonder, it's a brilliant opportunity for people, as an example, who are on the spectrum, who are autistic. However, there may be some others who are struggling and this isn't working for them. But that's not because it wouldn't. That's because of the structure of what's happening because of COVID-19. And something else you mentioned there, which I think is really important to remember, which is, you know, the lighting effect in you. You know, my wife has migraines and she gets visual aura. She's not neurodiverse. Mm. But light really and sound impact her hugely, especially if she's got a migraine coming on. So I think, you know, there's a massive opportunity here for organisations to make the environment much better for all of us. Mm. Because, okay, I might put up with bright blue lights that are supposed to represent real daylight, but actually are just bright. Don't bother me that much. But my environment would be improved if we got rid of them and put something nicer, right?
Yeah, exactly. But if you in the physical working place, somebody else might say in the office, I can't work in dim light. I can't do it. And they might not be being awkward. They just genuinely might need really bright light. Maybe they've got eyesight issues. So that manager is having to modify things to suit a number of different, an infinite range, actually, of diverse characteristics. And that's a blinking hard job to do. I talked about the legislation being a bit silent, a bit ineffective on this sort of focus and this label on disabilities. It's also a bit quiet on the matter of if you are managing somebody who is different, the disability tag's not one I want to use, but managing somebody who's different takes a long time. It takes more time to do two things than it does one thing. It takes more time to ring up the central lighting people in your organisation and say, can you sort out these lights, than it does if you didn't have to do that. And there's a number of small things, small steps that and conversations and referrals and, you know, filling in expense forms for a pair of decent quality headphones, which, by the way, I found out not so long ago is about £300 for a pair of headphones. So, you know, all those things, they take time. Somebody's got to pay for it. Somebody's got to administrate it. And although these are routine, you know, trivial kind of things, they do add up. And what the law doesn't do is it gives the employee actually a bit of extra time through longer breaks or more frequent breaks, which is great. They're tiny modifications. They make a big difference to somebody's performance. But it doesn't say anything about the poor manager who's, you know, by nature of their job, they have to look after people. That's what a manager is paid to do. It's not just to supervise, is it? It's to take account of individual circumstances and manage people differently. And then the minute you have a team where one person has quite a different set of requirements from the rest, it creates an extra workload. And I think, you know, managers vary hugely. Some are great. Some get that's part of the job. Some don't. In my research, I found most people were just curious. They wanted to know a lot more about what it's like to be autistic because they were open-minded to research, open-minded to finding out some more. So that's great. And their experience with their employees was really positive. But there will be some managers who just think, well, it's all a bit too much trouble. And I don't want this in my team. I want an easy life. I think that's a real danger for managing diversity of all sorts, actually.
So a couple of things.
Sorry,
No, absolutely not. This is spot on. This is interesting stuff. So a manager, the problem we've got here is you've got a manager who doesn't understand the individual and doesn't understand their needs and the support they require or how to enable their powers, if you like. And then you've got an individual who perhaps doesn't know what's affecting them, because actually I've met plenty of people like myself. I didn't know I was ADHD till 2 years ago. Mm. So you've actually got somebody who doesn't understand what it is they need as support, and then a manager who doesn't understand how to give it. And I think that when you consider that, that is a big challenge, right? And then you've also got, the need to get the best out of somebody, right? And if a manager has to put in extra work and all they see is putting in extra work to get somebody at a level peg, so to speak, then they're wondering why they do it. But my view is, if you've got somebody who's got unique skills, well, they may be very niche, little area they can fill, but those unique skills can make a huge impact to the performance of that team. But they've got to find a way to get at them. They've got to find a way to enable those skills. And I think if we can find that kind of nugget, and maybe you've got some thoughts on this, I think maybe it is time, I don't know, to educate managers and what have you, but that could really make a significant difference.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the research uncovered autistic strengths, some of the stereotyped autistic strengths around attention to detail that we've known about clinically for a long time. But the people I spoke to were saying, okay, I want, and good managers will do this with anybody, whether neurodiverse or neurotypical, but it's more, the impact is proportionately greater if you're allowing a neurodiverse person to show their strengths, because it's, how can I say, if you don't do that, the impact is has worse outcomes for that person. So that's what we want. We want managers who can spot autistic strengths and use them. So I had things like people with real high capacity for detail, having managers say, well, look, I want you, you're the person in the team that I know can check the spreadsheet. You know, my job actually as a manager is to be responsible for the data integrity that comes out of this team, but I know that you will do a better job than me. So please, will you do it? And that's, you know, that's an interesting one, isn't it? A double-edged sword, because on one hand, you're then expecting or asking, you're not expecting, you're requesting somebody to work at a level above, because you're saying, okay, I want you to do that bit of the job that I would do. But I spoke to managers who said they'd stop after a few weeks of somebody who they knew was so good at detail doing that spot check and doing that sort of final run through before it went off to the board. They've stopped, as a manager, they've stopped doing it because they can't do it, and they know they can't do it any better or any quicker than that the particular person that in the team that they were talking about. So it's a really good example of strengths. Flip side of that sometimes is people who are really high in detail are seen by the rest of the people in the team as pedantic, you know, having to spend that time doing the detail. But hey, what an opportunity, because there's an also a lot of those kind of jobs that people don't want to do, other people don't want to do. So it takes a really skilled manager, I think, to strike that balance between not exploiting, you know, not expecting somebody to do things over and above that they're paid to do, and taking advantage in that way, and giving people work that is interesting and productive and benefits the team. So that kind of divvying up the tasks, tweaking the jobs, I would call it crafting, job crafting, is, you know, you can't do it just on the fly. You've got to think about it. You've got to think about the skills of your team. But as I said before, and any HR manager and any good manager would agree with me, I think that you would expect people to do that for a team, whoever it's comprised of. It's just that the impact can be much greater if you're able to do that for a neurodiverse person.
Yeah, and I see that myself. I know I'm not process orientated, almost painfully so. You know, I find it really, really difficult. I work in heading up a recruitment team and job where, you know, it's about data, it's about process, it's about managing candidates through, it's about ensuring that each part of the detail is ticked off, and I'm not that person. So it's again, have I chosen the wrong career? Do I never work in this type of job again, or actually do I ensure that I've got the right support around me to empower me, and equally that my manager is supporting me to achieve that and they recognize that, and rather than going, you're not process orientated, ultimately you're going to fail in this job, it's about communication, it's about being creative and dynamic around the way that we do things and pushing the boundaries, and that is powerful in itself. So if you only focus on one element that may be 50% of the job, but if you only focus on that element and you only get somebody who's detail orientated and process orientated, you are going to miss out on some of the other elements. Maybe the creativity, the dynamic thinking around how you structure these processes and who you get engaged and how you move things along. Mm. So I absolutely agree. And I still believe from my own experiences and from what I hear of others, that this is not happening, that generally people like myself or people with autism are kind of either luckily falling into the right place and the right job or not, and obviously it can have devastating effects if they're not, and I think there's a lack of structure around this. So what, on that basis and the great research that you've done, I mean, tell us a bit more about the research and how much time and energy and effort went into the work that you've done, and maybe some final tidbits for managers, organisations that they may want to consider or where they can go for help.
Okay, yeah, so the research took, the data gathering took about 3 years. So I finished the data collection in 2017. Wow. So it does sound a long time, that, doesn't it? I sort of travelled up and down the country to speak to different people. I wanted to go and visit them, see what their work environment was like, so I could make a bit more sense of the findings. And overwhelmingly, I found that, you know, people were willing to talk, share examples, and actually that they did want quite a bit of support, because in general, and I think the situation has changed for the better now, HR managers, occupational health people didn't really understand autism, so they couldn't really provide help to managers who were having to negotiate Equalities Act legislation, policies, figure out what they could and what they couldn't do under things like recruitment policies. Promotion was an interesting one. I had an awful lot of people say to me, you know, I know that this chap, this person, this lady that's working for me is really skilled and really capable, but how can I have a career development conversation with him or her if what she says or he says is, I want to do this job because that's where I'm fitting best, in the same way you've just talked about, you know, when you get that nice match of skills to job. And some of the guilt, some of the discomfort that managers have and saying, you know, actually I'm keeping somebody in this job and they can't progress them because the organisation wants to keep them, both they want to stay where they are, the organisation wants them to stay where they are because they're doing such a good job. Is that right? And is that just a sort of easy way out of not promoting somebody? Do we need to question the assumptions that we make about why it is that somebody doesn't want to be promoted? Is it because they're so fearful that once they're out of that comfort zone, things are going to be really difficult? And are we not allowing someone's potential to really develop? I think, you know, a massive under-researched area is senior managers who are autistic. You know, there will be some. I know from my own conversations, my own contacts, that there are people who are really successful and are high up in the organisation, but we don't know much about how they got there, whether it was luck or coincidence, or did the organisation do something to really manage that transition in a way that they would do differently to somebody who's not neurodiverse? I think that's a real interesting area to look at. This obsession with teamworking is, I think, part of the issue around how people get on and get promoted. Most job adverts, most internal promotions to leadership positions talk about teamworking. They talk about distributed leadership. And with that word teamworking comes connotations of somebody who's very highly social, somebody who's very comfortable in flipping from different communication styles with different members of the team. And I think that we have to just question what we mean by teamworking in a leadership position. It's not necessarily all that stuff about being social. And perhaps a better description is team contribution and team effectiveness. Lots of competency frameworks are riddled through with descriptions of teamworking and that's a really valued competence. And of course, it is a valued competence. You don't want an organisation where people don't want to work together in a team. But I think autistic people suffer particularly from that because it's overladen with descriptions of comfort with social activities, getting to know your team, and some of those things are just a little bit difficult or perhaps not a preference for an autistic person. You know, there's a comfort with some level of social interaction, but not the same way. And until we start to understand what that is and are, as a neurotypical population, okay with that we don't all have the same requirements for busy social lives and after work events, you know, that it's not a geeky thing to do, it's just different, then I think that promotion to leadership positions will be difficult for autistic people until we unpack what we mean by leadership, because there's absolutely loads of strengths in a team leader around objectivity, around detachment, around being fair, around understanding the detail of a situation before you jump into any decision. Not being a knee-jerk reactor is a good thing. And I think that those sort of skills could really come to the fore in leadership positions. We just have to make sure that we set the environment so that people can progress upwards in a safe way and not be thrown into something that feels like so, so different. So I think there's an argument for mentoring autistic people. That's why an autistic person that's really successful in an organisation has such a lot to give back down the line. I'd like to see a bit more emphasis on successful role models in organisations.
Well, I certainly would like to see more of that. I think one issue that I have that frustrates me, Anne, is whenever I read new documents coming out on autism in the workplace, whatever it may be, or neurodiversity in the workplace, I still see 20... things to tell you about the issues or disabilities or whatever else it is to the three things that are going to make them successful. That really frustrates me. And this is often written by universities and organizations supporting it. So these are people who are, you know, maybe researchers or whatever, creating this information. I think that's wrong. I mean, I understand that there's some level of disability out there. And it's complex, right? So you may be autistic, but who knows your upbringing? Who knows the other impacting factors that affected you? You know, so they sometimes just kind of get all mishmashed into one. And I don't think that's fair.
Yeah. And also it's a massive conclusion from the research is that it's the socio-cultural factors. It's all the things that happen, not just in terms of the physical workplace, but all the norms we have about what good teamworking looks like. The norms we have that, you know, somebody who sits on their own or prefers to sit on their own at lunchtime is odd. They're not odd. They're just different to the people that want to sit together at lunchtime. You know, why is that odd? It's different to the majority, but that's a really simplistic guide to differences in behaviour. So I think until managers have an understanding of what is normal and typical, and how that sometimes is different for an autistic person, but it's not wrong or bad, it is actually just that, it's different, then, you know, that's the route to understanding, really, understanding that we take for granted so much of what is normal. And once you stop doing that, once you say, okay, it is what it is, then the perspective that you can put on using an autistic person's strengths, of which there are many, changes a lot. And you have to think about, okay, so how do I modify my style? How, not just how do I modify the environment, how do I modify what I ask this person to do? And that should be something that I do as a manager and I seek to do.
Yeah, definitely. And what else, Anne? I mean, what's in the future for you now? I mean, you've done this research. It's incredible. And I mean, I could keep talking to you about the things that have come out of it. But what do you plan to do next?
So my next research study is to look at successful people high up in an organisation. I'm really interested in how they've got there. And like I said before, is that just luck? Is it accident or design? And if it is design, which I'm sure in most of these things is a bit of both, but I'd like to know what the design part was in terms of what their organisations have done. Sometimes that success comes in different places as well. Success is, I'm going to be talking to people who have set up their own business, often through the frustration of not being able to do work in the way that they wanted to work in a larger organisation that's less flexible. So they're my two research studies. Oh, and yeah, no, the other one is I want to explore this capacity of objective decision making. So that sort of started to emerge at the end of my research, but because the jobs I was dealing with weren't big enough jobs to really explore how people were making higher level decisions. There were some, you know, there were skilled jobs, but they weren't top jobs right at the top of the organisation. So I want to see how we can use that capacity in times where you really need, and this is a good one, isn't it, where we are at the minute, we really need the data, and we need to understand that data in an objective way, not in a politically, not in a way that's manipulated or massaged by what the politicians want us to say. And I think that that capacity in autistic people particularly is underknown and underused. So that's what I'm going to be looking at.
Brilliant. And finally, anything else you'd like to share with us that's come out of the work that you're doing or the work that you'll be doing in the future? And then I guess, how can people connect with you, get in contact? So, I mean, this really interesting work, and I'm sure people will want to support and help and get involved where they can.
Okay. I think so. Next steps for me, as well as doing the research, I'm going to be doing some briefings once normal life, once we can do a little bit more face to face, based up in Nottingham. So if people want to contact me about that, they can through my LinkedIn profile. Do I need to say what that is, or well, that'll be?
Yeah, I can share that within the podcast content afterwards. So if people are listening and they'd like to find your details, they'll be able to find the link in the content. So have a look there and you'll be able to get in contact with Anne directly.
Okay, yeah, thank you. So top tips, I think believe in what, when someone says that the lights are difficult, or that some of the social interaction is difficult, to believe them. You know, when people say, I need some accommodations, I need some support, whatever language we're going to use, you really have to believe that, even though you can't see the condition. That's the biggest thing, I think, that if someone is saying to you, this works for me and this doesn't, just because you can't see the condition, you can't see why it's different, you can't see somebody in a wheelchair or wearing specs or wearing some sort of assistive aid, then it's still real, it still exists, and we should not be shy of that. We should be able to face that head on and have a conversation about it in a way that is designed to use strengths, not to manage disability, and to be much more upfront about the fact that autistic people, you want to know more about them, you want to know about the strengths. Because we hear enough about disability, you know, there's just, I think, what did you say, 30 to 3? That's like just not good, is it? You want it to be at least half and half, to be fair.
Yeah, absolutely. It isn't good enough, because there's already been enough information and content out that's negative. So, yeah. And I know sometimes, and people will say to me, and which is a fair point, you know, not every person who's neurodiverse, you know, considers themselves to be a superhero or have superpowers.
No.
Now, my argument to that is, define what a superpower is, because I think, you know, the smallest of action that has the biggest impact is a superpower. Other people may not see it, but if this little thing that somebody does, like managing data or whatever, to everyone else it's this boring task. For me, it's a superhuman power because nobody else in the team can do it, and this person's doing it. And for me, that's how I talk about superhuman powers. It doesn't have to be people who fly through the sky, although I joke about that, you know, that you can fly. And But that's the thing we need to be looking at for me. And if somebody wants to identify themselves as having a disability and somebody feels that it massively negatively impacts their ability to do work, whatever it is, that's that individual's right to see it in that way. And I guess I take it personally as my right to be able to say, you know what, I'm defining it as a superhuman power. And I'm defining these people who want to be in this group or want to talk about it in this way, you know, that that we do talk about it as superpowers. And I think I'd rather, I'm of a positive mindset though. So, you know.
I totally get that. I think that there are certainly the words super powers that we don't understand, I think. And that makes them superpowers, doesn't it? Because it's we don't understand how people systemize. The clinicians don't really know how that happens. But from a manager's point of view and an organization's point of view, you just need to know that it can. But it does, there is a little bit of caveat with that, because it can set people up to be really anxious that they're not seen as a genius. They're just seen as a bit odd. You know, that the sort of Greta Thunberg thing with she's self-declared Asperger's pretty recently, isn't she? You know, is it now expected that a young person with Asperger's should be changing the world, should be doing something absolutely amazing? Because it's still a spectrum, isn't it? And there's still people will have huge amounts of drive and go-getting in the way you're describing, you know, what you're doing, Theo. You're stepping out of your organization, aren't you, to do this kind of stuff and to get the word out there. But not everybody will have that same passion. And I think that with the education piece is awareness that people on a spectrum are still they still differ within that spectrum, and just like anybody else will have different motivations and different interests, different capacities, and within that to tease out the things that are underused autistic strengths and how they can be used by employers. Because at the end of the day, you know, a good job, a fulfilling job, a job that pays well is a great thing to aim for.
Absolutely. Anyone. Especially given this current crisis, you know, people out of work, people struggling, people, you know, worrying for how they're going to get paid and feed themselves. So I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for the job that you can go and do and that you can get some level of enjoyment out of. And that is safe and actually allows you to be your best self, whatever that may be. I applaud that, and I think that's what we'd like. I guess the thing that upsets me is we're still not there, and the problem is, and the reason why a lot of people won't declare and won't put their hand up is because there's still a lot of discrimination. Even I know I'm in the safe environment now. Who knows where I'll be in 2 years? You know, and then, you know, you've communicated this loud and proud, and actually then it has a negative impact on you. That is a reality of the current world that we live in.
It's hard to imagine an educated employer saying that now. It's hard to imagine them that they would actually be that upfront with it and seek to discriminate. And I think you have to look at the person that's doing the discrimination as well as the policies that they're working in, because a lot of policies, like competency frameworks, career progression statements, requirements, are built-in discriminatory. But I think that it's subtle. I think that people don't really realise that it is, because they've just been there for so long and taken for granted wording in competency statements, the way we do interviews, the expectations we have about what's normal. They are deep-seated, you know, they take a long time to unpick. So I think there's a, you know, we have to really take people's actions in account of all that. But I'm not saying that's an excuse. There's never an excuse to be unkind and unfair. And that's what some people's discriminatory behaviour boils down to, doesn't it?
No, you're absolutely right. And mostly I see people want to do the right thing, and then they often just don't know how to. And I think coming back to time again, as you just mentioned, it's How do you find the time to rewrite all the job descriptions, to rewrite all the adverts, to set new frameworks for how you assess people, whether or not you use technology, whether or not you have the funding? I mean, actually, when you start to build these blocks, you end up with a very, very high up wall to making the changes, which it kind of brings us back round in a circle again.
Yeah,
doesn't it
does. Yeah. But did you see the thing about the young lad who, I think it was BT, no, it was Eon, that it was 21, he was a young graduate, and they put the office that he ended up working in was right outside where all the building work was going. So it was really noisy and really disruptive, and disruptive for anybody, but particularly so for this young lad. And his manager said, I mean, the transcript's on the internet somewhere. His manager said something like, well, I don't believe you, or what a big fuss about nothing, mountain out of a molehill type thing, which is what sometimes the people I spoke to said that's what they were worried about. They're worried that be seen as making a mountain out of a molehill by asking for adjustments. And so he took them to court for unfair dismissal. She made his life so difficult that, and then fired him because of some performance issue brought on by all of the difficulties around the environment. And he took them to court and won on appeal. Had to go to appeal.
Rightly so.
Yeah, I know. I thought, gosh. And to do that against all the odds, and we're seeing that more people are representing themselves. Terry Brooks, the young law student, is another one. And I'm sure there'll be others coming out of the woodwork. But we don't want to get to that stage, do we? We want to for people to have fulfilling careers so they can be there and be successful and be role models. They can role model a hidden condition, which is really difficult to do because, you don't want to be talking about your inner things all the time. If you're a successful woman in a man's world, it's obvious. You don't have to say that. It's obvious. People can see that. If you're a successful project manager from a black and ethnic minority background in a predominantly white sector, you can also see that. You don't need all that explanation. But somebody who's autistic who's made it, why should they have to go around explaining that they're a bit different? It's that hidden, invisible nature that makes life, makes the management of diversity more challenging and complex, I think, but ultimately rewarding.
Absolutely. And real pleasure having you on. It was a real pleasure all the months ago that I spoke to you. And I hope that people reach out to you and support the work that you're doing. It's brilliant.
Oh, thank you so much.
You've been listening to Neurodiversity at Work, available on all good podcast hosts. Please do sign up now, like, share, and comment. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you.